have been in the book of Romans. Paul's been laying out the details of the gospel, and many of the passages have been detailed, abundant in deep theological expression. At some points hard to understand, but rich. But Paul, as he's transitioning into this a lot more applicable section, almost reaches a staccato kind of feel in this next section. I mean, even the portions we just studied about spiritual gifts and serving in the church were much richer and fuller explanations, probably because we needed them. But as he gets to this section that we're going to be going through in the next couple of weeks, he gets to a place where he's just going to rattle off a few instructions. And they're not complicated. They're not hard to understand. They're just a lot harder to do. As I've said before, some things are easy. They're simple, but they're not easy. And we'll probably find that as we go through this list of very simple concepts, we'll say, wow, that's something I just would struggle with. This is where I really have a hard time implementing the gospel in my life, because we all know, we talked about this a little in Sunday school this morning, we all know that we're not perfect. God saved us, Christ has redeemed us, we are reconciled, we stand before God as if we had no sin at all, but we stand before other people still with lots of sins and failures. They know it, and we know it. We don't try to hide it. You know, when we preach the gospel to people, we're not telling them, hey, you should become perfect like me. We're saying that the very reason I'm standing here telling you this is because I know I need to be saved just like you need to be saved. And Christ is the only one that can do it. He is working on us. Don't you love that old song? He's still working on me to make me what I ought to be. It took him just a week to make the moon and the stars, the sun and the earth and Jupiter and Mars. How loving and patient he must be. He's still working on me. We know that. He's working on all of us. So Paul's going to give us some instruction on what the life of a living sacrifice looks like. It's kind of the content of the rest of the book of Romans. I beseech you, therefore, beloved, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice. How do we live as a living sacrifice? We told us we're not to be conformed to the image of this world. We're supposed to be serving each other with the gifts that God has given us. And now he's going to rattle off quite a few instructions here. My family actually memorized this passage, and so I want you all to be watching them as I say some of these to see if they're mouthing it and getting it right. Okay, this will help us review. Now, probably not. We struggled through this one. Sometimes when you're memorizing a passage, there's a nice flow of thought that helps you remember what the next statement is. This one doesn't have it, only in a couple places. So as we get into it, you'll find he's just going to rattle off these instructions. My wife the other day said, this is like when parents are leaving the house and leaving the kids alone. Like you have some older kids that are going to be watching the younger kids, and you say, you start rattling off instructions. Don't answer the door. Don't use the stove. Don't let the three-year-old out of the house. You know, just things like this. And if you have, some of you probably had children like I have children that you have to think of the crazy things that you never thought you would have to think of. Like, you know, don't swing your brother from the clothesline. I mean, I wouldn't ever thought I'd have to say that, but I do. So Paul's going to go through this whole list of scenarios for us and help us understand what the life of a living sacrifice looks like. And so he begins by saying, let love be genuine. And this is starting in verse 9. Let love be genuine. This is also one of those areas where the division of verses in the text is not all that helpful to us. You know, that didn't happen until much later after the text was written. So I hope you understand those verses and chapter divisions aren't inspired. They're put there to be helpful. I mean, it'd be very hard for me to say, turn to the portion in Romans where it says, let love be genuine. And you would all say, I know I've heard that somewhere, but where is it? Great example, actually, when Jesus goes to teach in one of the synagogues, and it says they read him the scroll to read, and he says he went through it and found the place where it says, and he reads his passions. He had to know exactly where on the scroll that was, because they didn't have verses and chapter divisions at the time. And so he would have had to know, well, the passage I want to read from is about 3/5 of the way through this scroll, because their scrolls were very good copies of each other, by the way. But I'm kind of off on a tangent. Let love be genuine. I've got a couple of remarks written up on the screen for you there, and the one says, without hypocrisy, and the other says, without masks. Now, I know that the term without masks today means some things that we wouldn't have to think about a few years ago. But the term genuine here is the word that literally means non-hypocritical. Hypocrite is a Greek word that was applied to the stage actors of Greek plays, because they had these little masks. If you've ever seen the symbol of a theater that's like two masks, black and white, that's how they expressed emotion on the stage back in those days. The actors weren't expected to portray the emotion on their own face. If they were upset, they'd hold up a sad face. I mean, yeah, you just picture these emojis popping up on their masks, but that's what they had, is they would have a mask that expressed dismay or fear or anger or whatever it was they were trying to display, and then the Greek actor would say his lines, and everybody knew, hey, he's supposed to be whatever the mask is portraying. Frequently throughout the scripture, Christ even uses this term in the Sermon on the Mount when he says, when you pray or when you give alms, don't be like the hypocrites. Don't be like the stage actors who wear masks. Don't put on a show. Don't pretend to be something you're not. So what's written on your face should be a real portrayal of what's going on in the heart. Love people that way. So I'm not putting on a pretense. I'm not trying to get something out of you. We've probably all run into somebody who at first seems very, very concerned for us. And later on you find out, they just wanted something. Like, how nice does the used car salesman seem at first? And then a week later when you say, hey, I've got some warranty work, then you find out if he really cares about you. We are supposed to be loving unhypocritically, without the mask. So I'm not trying to get anything out of you. You're not trying to get anything out of me. We are seriously trying to do good to the other person out of a love for them. Because we know that God loves them, because we know that Christ gave himself for that person, we love other people. John, in his epistle, 1 John. Dan, I could have you sing this one because I know you know this song. 1 John 4:7-8. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. He that does not love does not know God, for God is love. It's such an intrinsic part of the character of God that he loves his people, that if we say we know God, we'd better practice and learn how to love people too, warts and all, faults and all. Yes, they're going to sin against us. They're going to mistreat us, but we are to love them despite those things, because God is a God who loves his enemies. Paul's going to get to that later on too. Love without masks, without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil and hold fast to what is good. The Christian's appetites and cravings should constantly be directed towards things that are wholesome and good, towards things that are uplifting, that are encouraging. That we are, as we go throughout our Christian life, learning how to not just shun the things that are evil, but embrace the things that are good. There's so many illustrations of this in our eating. Because you know what happens if I eat cookies and cake all the time. What do I begin to crave? More of the same. You know, once in a while I'll say, wow, do I feel really famished for some green beans? But after a while, you know, the thought of green beans will not occur to you as something that'll be satisfying if you've been living on chips and cookies and cake. What you feed the body is what it begins to crave. So if I feed it junk food all the time, it's going to crave more junk food. I joke around sometimes with the kids and I'll say, you know what, I feel like my blood pie levels are getting a little low. I need a little bit more pie. Get those levels all balanced out, right? Well, when Paul tells us abhor what's evil, That really is a term for shun it. Vehemently shun it. Don't toy with it. Act like it's a spider that just ran up your arm while you're digging in the garden. And that's how we are supposed to act when we see something evil. It is a thought out there that says, look, when we see evil things, we're supposed to just kind of take it in stride and be like, oh, well, you know, that's okay. Everybody sins. And granted, we are supposed to have compassion on people, and I'm not arguing that point. But there is a point to where we say we are supposed to be shunning what is evil. Now, this applies to me. I'm supposed to shun in myself, first and foremost, what is evil. So that every time an evil thought pops out of my head, I'm like, oh man, what a horrific looking spider. Get it off, get it off, get it off. Actually, I mean, when spiders run across my arm, it's more like, ah! Cut off the arm right there. It's fine. I'll lose the arm. You say, Dad, but the spider is 6 feet away now. It doesn't matter. Get rid of it. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good. So I'm supposed to be making decisions constantly about things that are beneficial to me and things that are contrary to me living like Christ. I have to make those decisions of discernment. Isn't the Christian life fun sometimes? As you go through periods of growth, and sometimes you'll shun things that later on you'll say, you know, there really wasn't anything wrong with that. But in the position I was at the time, I needed to distance myself from it. And often this happens when someone that's saved out of a sinful lifestyle will shun any connection to that old thing. And it doesn't necessarily mean that that thing was totally off. But sometimes to get established and get founded, you do need to make all those breaks. But we are to be constantly learning what is in accord with God's will. Back in chapter 12, verse 2, he says, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. It takes time, it takes maturity, it takes skill to learn what is good and what's not. So sometimes young Christians will dabble around in things that they shouldn't. Sometimes older Christians don't have the maturity that they should have. And you say, I can't believe after knowing Christ for as long as they do, they don't realize the dangers of that. Well, maybe you can help them. Maybe they'll come along in that. But that is where we're supposed to be working towards, abhorring what is evil, holding fast to what is good. Now, Paul doesn't give us a whole lot of specifics on those things. And therein lies the need to be discerning. God gives us a list of commandments. Those things are somewhat broad, and sometimes it takes a lot of skill to be able to say, well, this command applies to this situation in life. What kind of entertainment am I going to indulge in? Is it good? Is it acceptable? Is it perfect? Does it mesh up with what Paul says in Philippians about me devoting my mind to things that are pure and beautiful and lovely and of good report? What kind of music? What kind of company do I keep? And I'm not saying we never rub shoulders with people that are sinners. We need to do that. So hopefully understand some of these lines have to be drawn in very fine places. But abhor what is evil. Hold fast to that which is good. That word hold fast is like the same word that is used for marriage. When Jesus quotes Genesis chapter 2, and he says, for this reason, the man will leave his father and his mother and will hold fast to his wife. He'll cling to her. He starts realizing that she is such a central portion of his life that he holds on to it because he loves her. He wants her around. He knows that she's completing him as that helpmate that God created. And he says, I don't want to lose this. Hold fast to what's good. So when we see the thing that is good, whatever it is, grab it. Hang on to it. Ah, boy, I don't want to let this go. This is good. This is helpful to me. This is going to help me grow in my Christ-likeness and in living as a living sacrifice. Jesus expressed this a little bit differently when he said, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Now, what am I mourning over? The context there of the Sermon on the Mount is, I'm mourning over my own sin, my own unrighteousness in my life. They break my heart that I still commit them. I don't like it that it's still there, but I recognize that it is my fault that it's still there. And I mourn over it. He says, you will be comforted, because there will come a day when Christ takes it all away. He's sanctifying us right now. He's working on us. He's making us more like himself. But there is coming a day when that will be totally complete. And the very presence of sin will be removed from our lives. And boy, what a day that will be. And that's why he says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. They will be satisfied. There come a day when I actually will be righteous. Totally and completely. And I'm yearning for it. I'm hungering for it. And I want it to be here. So I mourn over the things that are bad, and I'm craving the things that are good. John puts it this way in his epistle, don't love the world or the things that are in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Now, there is a lot that is out there in the world, and sometimes it looks flashy, and sometimes it looks good, and sometimes it takes us a while to recognize it isn't. But when I recognize it for what it is, what's my response to it? Am I going to continue to embrace it because I've learned to love it? Or am I going to say, no, this thing's actually bad for me. It's horrible for me. It's totally contrary to say, I love God, and then I cling to evil things. Now, we make allowance in this for saying somebody just might not realize what a bad thing it is yet. It happens. We're growing. We're all of us growing in this. But that's why the church is supposed to be working together, so that maybe you've come to a realization on something that's in the world. And you say, you know what, this is really bad because of this. And you might help me understand it and see it for what it is. So we want to cultivate in our church, cultivate in our homes, cultivate in our communities, a habit of gradually discarding the things that are evil and bringing in those things that are good. I think of a good example of this in the book of Acts. Paul plants a church, and he says there that the people recognize most of them were dabbling in magic arts because that was a pretty common part of pagan idol worship. It's becoming bigger today, by the way. And all these new believers suddenly realize, you know what, I've got all these scrolls of spells and incantations and things and potions in my house. That's contrary to living for Christ. And so they took them all and they burned them. They didn't sell them. And he tallies up, and I forget what exactly the number was, but it was a lot of money. A lot of money. And they said, I would rather destroy this and shun what's evil than even cling to the profit I could gain from it. I'm getting rid of it. Completely destroying it. And a great example of abhorring what is evil and clinging to what is good. So cultivate that mindset in your own mind, in your own home, and you're in this church as we work together. And hopefully that'll spread out into our communities too, of shunning what's evil and clinging to what's good, holding fast to what's good. Continues on, love one another with brotherly affection. As we seek each other's welfare, and I actually like the way Mark Lowry put this. He says, someone came to him one time and said, you know, God likes you. And he says, you know, I know we're supposed to love everybody, but there's some people that you love that you wouldn't go on vacation with. He says, because you don't like them. Or you don't like them that well. But we genuinely are supposed to be a group of people that like each other. We enjoy being around each other. We enjoy that time of fellowship and camaraderie, brotherhood that we're supposed to have with one another. So that as we come together as the church body, we're glad to see each other. Glad to catch up. Say, boy, how's your week been? I'm concerned about you. I've been praying for you. Hey, I was thinking about you as I did this or that. Here, I thought of this. Here's something I saw. I thought this would help you. It should be a place we enjoy coming to because we enjoy the people that are there. Love one another with brotherly affection. Be a place we enjoy coming. I hope this church is a place you enjoy being at. Love one another with brotherly affection. You see how some of these aren't real complicated? I mean, that's a pretty simple concept, isn't it?
Sometimes you have to work at that, though.
Yes, you do. I mean, Ed has to work hard at being likable. You heard him say that, right? No, we do. You're right. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Here's one we really have to work at. Because the concept here is like we are in a competition. But it's not a competition to win a prize for me. It's a competition to give a prize to you. I am striving to honor you before you can get to honoring me. And if we put it in those terms, it's like, who said this wasn't a fight? Or who said this wasn't a game that we're all going to play? No, you can't honor me because I'm going to be honoring you. And it's not in a false sense of humility that's like, well, I'm going to honor you and hopefully you're going to outdo me. And then I'll like, well, okay, but thank you. The sense really is that we are striving to get ahead of the other person. It's like, oh, rats, you just honored me. Nah, I need to get ahead and show you more honor. Not because I want to win the game, but because I really see you as more valuable than myself. I really see you as somebody that deserves to be honored above me. You get this joke about newlyweds and like, I love you. No, I love you. And that's really the way it ought to be in the church. As we honor one another, as we show how valuable you are to me. And it doesn't have to be in quirky and weird ways like that, like we tease young newlyweds for. But in genuine ways of showing thoughtfulness, showing that I was thinking about you, showing that I care about you, and that as we are constantly doing that, we satisfy one another's need to know that you are valued, to know that you are honored, to know that you are loved. And we're constantly doing that. One of the things, as you counsel folks who are struggling in their marriage, that you constantly have to reinforce, because the question continually comes up is, well, you know, I do this for her, but what does she do for me? You know, my needs aren't being met. So that's not the point. You're not supposed to be thinking about your needs. You're supposed to be thinking about hers. Well, then who's going to meet my needs? She will. Or he will. But as you're supposed to be so intent on meeting the other person's need that you're not worried about your own. And yes, the other person is supposed to be so intent on meeting your needs that they're not worried about their own, but that's how the marriage relationship goes. Each so concerned about loving the other person that you're not worried about receiving the love yourself. I know that's the ideal. And we often all fall far short of that. But that's where the Lord wants us to be, both in our marriages and in a different sort of love, of course, in our church. But we are really striving to outdo one another in showing honor and affection and love for one another. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Don't be slothful in zeal. Be fervent in spirit. Serve the Lord. These three actually do go together. The first two describe how we're to accomplish the last. Don't be slothful in zeal. How many of you have ever been to the zoo and seen a sloth? Aren't they fun? I mean, you watch those things and you'd swear they're not even alive. And yet they're moving. I mean, they just like real slow. And they just reach from one branch to the next and grab their way along. And then they sleep for 17 hours a day. It's kind of like Ethan. Sorry, bud, you knew that was coming, right? Radar picked that one up a long time ago. Yeah, until you've had that first cup of coffee, right? That's how I feel. All right. Don't be slothful. Don't be unmotivated. Don't be low energy when it comes to serving the Lord. Be fervent in spirit. It's kind of the opposite sides of things. We're not supposed to be lacking the energy needed to invest in whatever task it is we're doing. He's going to talk about here serving the Lord and what that looks like, but here again, He doesn't give a whole lot of detail because what is serving the Lord? Everything you do should be. Even getting up in the morning, making that bowl of oatmeal, taking that bike ride, pulling weeds out of the garden, going to work, talking to your neighbor. All of those aspects of life, everything, in our homes, in our neighborhoods, in our church, everything's about serving the Lord, isn't it? Whether we eat or drink, do it all to the glory of God. You were bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body and your spirit, which are His. The word there, serve the Lord, is the verb form of slave. Be the Lord's slave, and don't be slothful about it. Don't be half-hearted about it. Be zealous. Be fervent. Let that inner fire burn a little bit about getting done what the Lord wants you to do. Now, this isn't talking about the kind of zeal that we sometimes think of that's like a quick explosion. You know, how useful are quick explosions for getting work done? Nah, not very good. They cause a lot of damage, they make a lot of racket, but they really don't get much accomplished, do they? But you know what? If you can harness those little explosions into a series of continually small explosions, what do you get? You get a diesel engine that can pull how much weight? Diesel engines can pull an awful lot of weight, can't you? And you know what that is? That's just a series of controlled explosions. And Ernie says, you know, I never thought about it that way. Maybe I don't want to get back in that thing. Same thing in mowers, right, Gary? Yeah. This is talking about the kind of fervent zeal that doesn't burn out quickly. The kind that's dedicated to a task that takes a lifetime. Oh, it's easy to get excited about some projects, but what often happens? We get excited, we get into it, we make a mess, and then, oh man, now this is really starting to look like a lot of work, and our zeal starts to fizzle out. And then we realize, oh, this is too tough. Oh, it's too hard. Forget it. I'm done. But the kind of zeal Paul is talking about here is the kind that means I get into a task, and like Nehemiah, when it gets hard, I start problem solving. How can I keep doing this? So you know what, folks? Now we've got to deal with another problem. We're not just building a wall. Now we have to face off the enemy. So you're going to have a trowel in one hand and a sword in the other hand. You're not only going to be building a wall, but you're going to be defending yourself. And it might take us longer to build that wall doing it this way, but we are going to build the wall. Folks, you've got to serve the Lord. Your life belongs to Him. He bought you. He owns you. You're His slave. Not in a negative, abusive kind of way. But you're His slave and He loves you. So serve Him. Make everything you do about what He wants you to do that day. And do it zealously. So whether you're caring for your family, that's an aspect of serving the Lord. Whether you're being good members in your society, that's serving the Lord. Whether you're being a good employee, that's serving the Lord. Paul's got some instruction in chapter 13 about how we're to be good citizens, serving the Lord. In our churches, serving the Lord. All of these things we should deal with zeal, knowing that we're serving the Lord Jesus who bought us and to whom we must give an account of our service. So whatever it is He puts into our hands to do, we're supposed to do it zealously. Make sure it gets done well. Not with an explosive, I'll get everything started and then fizzle out, but control it, focus it, make sure it happens. This is long term. Serve the Lord with zeal. Don't be slothful. And I know we all have ups times and we have down times, and that's why we're here to encourage one another, so that when I see you're feeling a little fizzled out, I might be able to come alongside you and say, hey, come on, man, let's keep going. Let's keep doing this. You're not done yet. Now, I would rather bang myself in the head with a hammer than run a marathon. But I got to have a lot of respect for people that run marathons. All the much more because I don't want to do it. How do you motivate yourself to run all that distance and keep pushing your body even after it's screaming at you, stop it, stop it, stop it, stop it, I'm tired, let me rest for a minute. And you say, no, we're going to keep going because the finish line's still up there. But that's the idea. Where's the finish line? I don't know. Do I have another 10 years? Do I have another 30 years? Do I have another 50 years? I don't know. You know, sometimes that's the hardest race to run when you can't see the finish line. But I know that finish line will come one of these days. And when I cross it, I want to be able to look right in the eyes of my Lord and have him say, "Well done, you good and faithful servant. You did what I wanted you to do. You didn't quit. You didn't give up. You didn't get tired. Well, maybe you got tired at times, but you didn't stop. Well done." Don't be slothful in zeal. Kind of contrary to slothful, goes along with being zealous, is rejoice in hope. Keep an eye forward on the promises and let them fill your heart with joy. Who other than believers in God have reason to be joyful? God has given us a whole slew of promises. We sing songs about them. Standing on the promises of Christ, my King. Promises that can't fail, promises that can't fall, promises that can't be thwarted or stopped or undone. And they are good. They are joyful things, but it does require that we have an eternal outlook on life that says, I'm kind of looking past everything that's between me and them, and I'm looking right at the promises because I want to see those accomplished. Some of them are for this period in life. You know, God does give us promises for this period in life. He does promise us some things. Not all, but some. And we know that ultimately all those promises will be fulfilled when we stand with Christ and we stand with the throng of people that have followed him before us and gone on before us. And we know that when we get there, the power of sin in our lives will be broken, the presence of sin removed, we'll be present with Christ forever. Christ will rule the world, we'll rule the world with him. We'll be with all the other believers that we've known throughout our lives and even the ones that we've only read about and get to talk to them and fellowship with them. Our bodies will be raised and perfected just like Christ's body was raised and perfected. We'll have our reward for our life of service. Our trust in Christ will be vindicated. There's going to come a day when all of those times when people told us you're nuts, they're going to be proved wrong. We'll be proved right. And we'll say, it wasn't in vain that I put my hope in Christ. Our enemy will be defeated. Death itself will be defeated. And the world will be made new. Could we go on? We have more promises than these. But sometimes the things that are happening right now start bubbling up and we kind of take our eyes and we start looking down and say, wow, that looks ugly. It looks difficult. That looks horrific. I can't ever see anymore how I would ever get there from here. Or as they say in Maine, you can't get there from here. Right? But God says you can. So we have to keep that eternal perspective because the Christian life is not one which doesn't have any trouble or pain. Sorry, Joel Osteen. God didn't promise me that I'll always be prosperous and always be successful and doesn't always want me to be happy. He wants me to be obedient. He wants me to be faithful. Does that come with some measure of prosperity? You better be careful how you define that. But God also told me that I'm going to have trouble. I'm going to have tribulation. I'm going to have trials. There's going to be persecution involved at times. The very fact that we still live in a cursed and sinful world means the Christian life is not one that's easy. So I have to keep an eternal perspective that says, there's the promises, I got to keep moving towards them. Even if it's only, boy, I can only see one step ahead of me. You know, the promises look kind of dim out there. That light's not as bright as it used to be, but boy, I just, one more step. And maybe another one and they'll brighten up, but I keep moving. Rejoice in hope, knowing God has given us wonderful promises. Remind yourself of them. You know, sometimes we do just have to just repeat through our minds, what's he told me is true? What has he given me as a promise? Because I've got to hang on to that like a lifeline through this difficult time. Well, alongside that, be patient in tribulation. You know, patience is the idea of bearing up under something, being able to hold the weight of it. We're able to remain under is literally what the word means, to remain under. Patience means that even though I'm under a tremendous weight of tribulation or temptation or persecution or whatever it might be, I don't give up my faith in Christ. I don't walk away from it. I don't say, you know what, this pressure's too much, the trouble's too hard, I'm done. Like the seed that fell among the thorns, it says it grew up, but when it started getting choked out by the cares of life, it withered up and died. Or the seed that fell among the stones and grew quickly and fervently, but then dried up when the sun came out. That's not what I want to be. That's not what Christ calls me to be. He says, bear patiently. So if the sun's getting hot, you keep digging your roots deeper, looking for that water. If the weeds are getting thick, well, there's plants, not much they can do about that. They have to depend on us gardeners mostly. But if the weeds are getting thick, I cry out more constantly to my gardener, deliver me from this. Come pull these weeds. I'm about to be swallowed up by lamb's quarters and purslanes and oxalises. And trust in your gardener to come and rescue you. Be patient in tribulation. Isaiah chapter 40 says, they who wait for the Lord will renew their strength. They'll mount up with wings like eagles. They'll run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Sometimes I think that's not that exhilarating feeling like we might expect, but more that we turn around and say, how in the world did I ever get this far? Because he carried me. I didn't give up because he held me. Like the little child that's learning to walk, walks along holding mommy and daddy's hand, and every time they trip and fall, they don't bust their beak on the cement because daddy's got their hand. You see this picture of them just dangling there, holding on to mom and dad's hand, and you have to lift them back up until they get their feet again, and then you help them go forward. That's us. We're patient in tribulation, not because we are strong, but because our God is strong. And the more we depend on him, the more patient we can be. Which is why Paul leads in with this next one. You know, how do I be joyful in tribulation? How do I be patient under trial? Because I'm constant in prayer. Because I give thanks, I express praise, I ask for provision, I ask for wisdom, I entreat God on the behalf of other people, I ask for their welfare, I ask for God to intervene in their lives. All of these things, I recognize that everything is in God's hand. Which means that if I need a solution and answer, I better look to him. Because he's the one that promised to give me that strength that I need. First of all, Paul says, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, giving of thanks be made for all people. For kings and all who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way. This is good, and it's pleasing in the sight of God our Savior, who desires all people to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. It highlights, though it focuses specifically on praying for our government and that they'll let us live for Christ as we see fit. It begins with that primary premise that I'm to be praying for all things. I'm to be constant in prayer. I'm to pray without ceasing, 1 Thessalonians says. So I have to ask myself, how often in the course of any given day do I find my mind offering up a prayer to God silently, or find my lips actually uttering the prayer in an audible way? How often am I actually praying about things? Or do I just keep figuring, oh, I just got to kind of lift myself up by my own belt and carry myself through? That's not what God called us to do. He called us to cry out to him. He called us to ask him to intervene. That might mean some responsibility on my part. He may deliver to me the strength I need to do what I'm supposed to do. He might part the Red Seas for me so that I can walk across without much trouble. But most of the time, it involves God giving me the strength to continue one more step and to keep going and to keep trying and to not give up. So I'm to be constant in prayer. Look at that. I got them running down the aisles. Paul's going to continue. We got lots more that he's going to go through, and I wasn't sure how far we would get today anyway. But all of these things that he's telling us affect just about every portion of our lives. Quick little snippets, things to think about. And probably one of these is going to hit you in a different way than it's going to hit you or you. But I hope that as we walk out of here, we'll be able to say, Lord, I want to become more like Christ in everything. Boy, this area, you've just really grasped me on today. So Lord, help me to grow in that. Help me to develop my Christ-likeness in that area so that I can serve you with even more zeal, even more patience. But don't forget in all of it, he's the one that will do it. Go to him in prayer about it. Ask him to strengthen you, to grow you, to establish you in that area. And boy, don't try to do this on your own. Go to him first. Your church is here as a resource as well. Depend on each other. We're going to close our time this morning singing this very familiar song, Take My Life, Let It Be Consecrated, Lord, to Thee, because I want to grow in the ways that you tell me I need to grow. Let's stand together as we close our time in singing this morning.